This is Lele Pons from Suite 305 with Lele Pons. Game day at my house, it's chaos, but like in a fun way. The TV's ready, the remotes are ready, the kids' toys are going off, and somehow everybody needs batteries at the exact same time. That's why I keep Duracell stocked. And Duracell just released limited edition Duracell and Messi battery packs. The design is inspired by Messi's iconic left leg tattoo. So every battery feels like it comes with an extra kick. From the TV remote to automatic corkscrew, Duracell keeps us game day ready. Duracell double and triple A batteries are the only ones built different with power boost ingredients for long-lasting performance you can trust. Find the limited edition Duracell and Messi batteries in stores at Lowe's and Walmart or on Amazon.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. In this week's edition of our Justice Warrior season, I have a very interesting guest. We've been trying to get away from all content creators and get into people that are out there doing work in the space that maybe you're not hearing about. I'm joined today by Iris Eitan. She is the CEO of Protect Ethical Prosecutors, which is an interesting title that we'll talk about. But she has made it her mission to fight against prosecutorial misconduct. It's a really cool organization. She has a background as a defense attorney. And I'll let her talk to more about her background. But Iris, thanks so much for joining me. It's great to meet you.
Awesome. Thank you. Great to be here.
So first things first, tell us about you've had a long career as an attorney with many accolades. I was seeing how you were named Barrister's Best Criminal Defense Attorney by Law Week Colorado. You were honored by Best Lawyers in America. I mean, you did a lot of great work as an attorney. Before you created or founded Protect Ethical Prosecutors. So first and foremost, tell us a little bit about your background and then we'll kind of move on from there.
Sure. In a nutshell, so I've been practicing law for a little more than three decades. It's hard to believe. And I started off in civil rights. I've done public defense, criminal defense. I come from a family that immigrated from Israel, so I'm a first-generation American, raised by healers, and law was how I chose to heal. I initially started representing people with mental illness. That's the reason why I went to law school, helping teens that were homeless or unhoused, and then people that were in jails and prisons that had mental illness. And I led a pro bono federal class action forcing the state of Colorado to stop warehousing people with mental illness in jails, not providing them treatment. And, you know, all of my, you know, my whole history is all about just wanting to help people. I didn't go to law school to try cases. I never took a trial class. And I was just driven by people, not by wins and wanting to help. And it just became through my work as a public defender and through doing criminal defense work that I saw how much, the system, how much of my clients that had mental illness were in this criminal, system. And I started seeing the abuses of, the people that should be adhering to the law were breaking the law. And it caused me to really get in and dig in to doing really more significant criminal defense cases. And then eventually now quitting criminal defense and starting this nonprofit.
That's so I'm real interested in kind of what you described as your motivation as an attorney. You said you described your family as healers. Like, tell me about that. What is the, you know, how did you grow up with your family? And because it's an interesting driver for, you don't hear a lot of that from people that go to law school, right? That I want to go just, you know, I want to heal people. I want to help people. I don't want to try cases. You don't generally hear that. So I'm super interested in what that background was like that shaped you.
Sure. I, you know, my mom and dad didn't know each other at the time. They were young, but they grew up in Iraq, in Baghdad, and they are Jewish. And at the time it was colonized by the British. And my dad, you know, his family kind of poured in their resources so that he could go to medical school in Iraq. And he finished his studies. And at that time, it was post-World War II, and there was ethnic cleansing happening all through, you know, these countries that weren't affected by, you know, the European countries that weren't affected by the extermination of the Jews. So it started happening kind of post-World War II in countries like Iraq. My parents fled to Israel, and my dad then finished his medical studies and was a doctor, and immigrated to the United States. And both my brothers were raised with that thinking that they also wanted to heal, and they became doctors as well. And I saw helping people. It's all I ever knew. It's all I ever learned about growing up was how to help people. What can you do to help people? And I really wanted to be a psychologist. That's where I felt the most I could use my, you know, I guess my personality and be more, it was more intuitive to me. And I worked in county mental health hospitals to make money through college. And I thought I was going to be a psychologist. And that's why I did that work, to make money. And while I was doing that work, I encountered just too many, what I thought were, and I think were, abuses of people that had mental illness that were locked in these mental health facilities. And there was one girl there that looked close to my age, and she was had an eating disorder. And for some reason, she was held in this locked facility. And one day there was somebody that was speaking to her that now looks like me. You know, yeah, she was wearing a suit and she looked very polished, and she was talking to this young woman who had an eating disorder. And I asked the nurses who that was, who's talking to her. And they said, oh, that's an advocate. And I said, advocate for what? Oh, she's a lawyer. She's going to help her get out of this facility. Really? Why? Yeah, well, because she probably shouldn't be here. And that's, you know, there's a law that says that, you know, you can fight getting out of here. And so that's really what, that was it. That was all I needed to hear, was that there was a way to not be in the system, but be around the system and help people who had mental illness, not be abused by the people that were supposed to be helping them. And so I decided to go to law school to help people like that young woman and people that were in mental health institutions.
That's great. It's a great foundation for where you've ended up now once you get in. So then you finally become an attorney and start working. And at some point you've discovered beyond, you know, the things that were happening to people with mental illness and things, you know, prior to them ever going to trial and things like the story you just told. But at some point you realize that once people get into court, there's prosecutors that aren't doing things quite right. Like, when did you have that revelation?
Not for a while. People don't believe this about me because they see me differently. You know, I've handled a lot of high profile cases and been on the 48 hours and the Dateline. And so they don't know this part of me that really naively believes in the system. And I always thought that, yeah, you're having wars between prosecutors and police officers, but I really didn't believe people lied. I just thought that they saw the facts differently, or maybe they didn't know the facts the same way that you did. I didn't really think that prosecutors, who are the same lawyers, they're lawyers just like me, that went to law school and learned constitutional law and took the bar exam like I did in California and Colorado, and took you know, the professional responsibility exam and knew their ethics, I didn't think that they were people that I need to be concerned about would be breaking the law that they were trying to enforce.
Right.
So it didn't really hit. I always thought that police officers were our natural enemy as a criminal defense lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
That was because that's who was encountering my clients and conducting the actual arrest, right? So, you know, it was the prosecutor that was taking the investigation of the police officers and moving that forward. I really separate. I was like most people, I think, in the United States, frankly, that believed that all prosecutors are really just like a good lawyer and they're really serving justice. And as the American Bar Association calls them, ministers of justice. And they really, you know, didn't, you know, cut corners in order to get convictions. It was hard for me to believe that that ever happened until probably, you know, a decade ago. The more experienced I became, the bigger cases I started handling. And the more I started scratching my head, like, why is this person being prosecuted, and asking more questions and doing more litigation about the discovery production, which is the prosecutors are mandated to provide, you know, police reports and evidence behind the case. They're mandated to do that. And I started finding out that they weren't really giving me everything. And then I started kind of, when I started asking for information, I wouldn't get it. I'd have to find out about it in other ways. And then I started really seeing that they were intentionally breaking the rules and not giving me evidence that they should and not following the rules. And so it was strange to me, because it was the bigger the flashlight, you know, the brighter that cameras were on a case, the more they wanted to win, and the more they cheated. And I want to be clear, I this revelation that I had, or started coming to see it happening in patterns over and over again in Colorado, it's not that I believe that all prosecutors are unethical. I don't. It's that I've had so many experiences, though, that have led me to believe that there is a pattern and an epidemic of misconduct. And truly, there are, I think, more prosecutors that do it often rather than a lot of prosecutors who do it a little bit.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
And it's really interesting from like another lawyer's perspective. I've never really thought about that way, that like I think we almost have in our mind like, these crooked prosecutors, as I mentioned, I work in wrongful conviction. So a lot of the cases that come across my desk that we're investigating, there was prosecutorial misconduct involved. I'm actually looking at your front page of your website right now, and it cites that 28% of exonerations cited prosecutors withholding exculpatory evidence. So like, we deal with that a lot. And so I almost feel like, not literally, but people tend to feel like, all these prosecutors doing all these crooked, shady things, they're learning all that in prosecutor school, But there isn't a prosecutor school, right? Like you guys, the defense attorneys, the prosecutors, you're all going to the same law school and you're learning the same ethics and principles and the way you're supposed to operate. And you know, some of them just get into this pattern of, I've talked to many prosecutors and I get the same thing from a lot of them. When I can get a prosecutor to talk to me where something like this happened. And I had one. It was devastating. It was a case where we ended up getting the guy out of prison, but he had served 18 years at that point. And I had uncovered the evidence, all the things that the police had done wrong, the prosecutors done wrong. And I actually got him to meet me in a bar and sit down and have a beer with me and look at this, like this case, and explain to him why I have this problem. And he told me, he's like, look, I don't care, which was shocking. He's like, I don't like, I when I go to trial, my job's to win. So I win. If we got the wrong guy and you can prove it, then I'll help you. And he helped us like get the conviction overturned. But that compartmentalization to me was shocking to me. Like how you can sleep at night knowing you sent this guy away from his family for 18 years. And now I'm showing you how you messed up. And you're like, huh, all right, well, let's get him out.
It's, I, Bob, I go back and forth between crying and rage mm-hmm. when I, you know, and dealing with and thinking about all the people that I've represented that have been wronged by prosecutors, and then all the people that I don't know, but people that you describe, and the stories and the people on our board, you know, for example, that have collectively spent decades in prison for something they didn't do. And it boils down to something for me that, after all this time working on these cases and, you know, quitting, you know, you kind of spun off some of my accolades that I've received, you know, through the years as a result of, you know, my advocacy and skill. It's not easy for, I don't think anybody, especially I have to say men, I don't like to be so gender specific, but to, you know, drop the mic and say, I'm going to leave this career that I was the top of my game of. Right. And mm-hmm. I'm going to let that go because I'm going to find a way to change the system and repair this. And that was really hard for me to do. And thinking and really taking a look at what was it going to take to do that? And what does it look like to repair the system? Because we all see these one by one exonerations that takes an extraordinary amount of legal work, lawyer commitment, and time and money. And you know this too, you know, after someone's exonerated, which we're at nearly 4,000 in this country, which is just, you know, it's the floor, not the ceiling, right? As mm-hmm. we all know. I couldn't stand to be in a courtroom anymore and be like just helping one more person. And so doing this research and finding out like, well, what's the greatest effect that I can make in terms of what the research looks like to stop prosecutors from committing misconduct? What does that look like? And they are shielded by what people don't know, most people don't know, as what's called absolute immunity. And so prosecutors cannot be sued like every other lawyer or professional or licensed individual in this country. They are shielded because 50 years ago, the United Supreme Court said, you know what? We don't want to bother you guys with lawsuits from people like Mr. Paul Imbler, who sued Richard Pacman, a prosecutor in Los Angeles, 50 years ago for hiding evidence of his innocence after Paul Imbler spent time on death row and a total of 10 years in prison and sued Mr. D.A. Pacman for his loss of time with his children, loss of his job, loss of his liberty. And the Supreme Court said, you know what? Mr. Pachtman can be criminally prosecuted for breaking the law and he can lose his law license. So we're not going to, you know, kind of burden prosecutors with this lawsuit business. Well, 50 years ago, when that happened, that gave prosecutors the shield to tell people like you, Bob, in your cases, I just wanted to win. I don't care. I just want to win. And so that's now their incentive. They're incentivized right now to win cases instead of to play by the rules. And when I say they, I want to be clear. I'm not saying every prosecutor, but unethical prosecutors. That's what unethical prosecutors do. They want to win at all costs, and they can because nothing happens to them. And we can get into talking about, you know, the scale of this problem, not just my cases that I've handled, not just the people on my board that are connected to this issue, not just, by the way, one of our board members who created the National Registry of Exonerations, who understands the scale of this, but we can talk about the numbers of prosecutors who have not suffered any discipline for the most egregious misconduct known in this country. And the scale is huge. And that's because they can't be sued because nothing happens to them. The scale is enormous. So if you look at, for example, the most egregious case of prosecutorial misconduct in this country, that was handled by two of PEP's board members, Rob Carey and Brendan Sullivan. They represented Senator Ted Stevens, who suffered a political indictment right before an election. He's an Alaskan senator. And it was a sickening prosecution, and he was exonerated before sentencing after finding out that prosecutors, federal prosecutors, had hidden so much evidence and created and manufactured evidence in his case. The judge said the worst case he'd ever seen. Okay. Those prosecutors, nothing happened to any of them. Not a single thing. They got elevated. They went on to bigger jobs. Nothing happened to them. They didn't lose their law license and they didn't get criminally prosecuted. Okay. And they were shielded by immunity. So if you look at the worst case, why would you question the statistic that has been studied across the last, 20 years, which is less than 2% of prosecutors that have committed founded misconduct, like in the cases that you just cited in the exoneration cases, less than 2% have suffered any employment discipline or professional discipline. What kind of incentive do prosecutors have then, unethical prosecutors, to play by the rules? None. I mean, they have none because they don't have skin in the game. And so look at the rest of us. You know, you could be sued for defamation, Bob. I could be sued for wrongly representing a client that I've had, you know, hiding evidence or making deals on the side to make sure that they don't, they're not free. There's a lot of ways that the criminal defense lawyers are sued amongst every other lawyer known to man, in this country that can be and is sued. And we're all insured, right? All of us, everyone is insured, and that's what insurance is for. But we are all held, we know that we can be held accountable, but we all usually live our lives ethically, so we don't have to worry about that, right?
Right.
And so the point being is that we have created this shield for prosecutors to pretty much do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want. And they have the power in this country to do that because people don't understand that judges are really powerless. I mean, I hate to say that because judges don't like to hear that. Mm-hmm. And it's different when it comes to the Supreme Court, of course. But, for the run-of-the-mill trial judge, it's the prosecutor that's deciding who to charge, when to charge, how to charge, why to charge, what evidence to hand over, and what sentence that they want the person to get. I mean, that's really mostly under the purview of the prosecutor. And because they can't be sued and they're never held accountable for their misconduct, What do we need to change? I mean, it seems like there's one single thing that happened 50 years ago, and it was a law that the Supreme Court invented called absolute immunity.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
I'm just about to shift into the work that you're doing that, but there's one thing that I just want to point out too that is always frustrating to me is the scale you talked about and us knowing like the number of prosecutors that are doing this or the amount of prosecutorial misconduct. We have ways to do like some statistics. Like you said, there's been, you know, about 4,000 exonerations. We know one in three of those, about a third of them, involved prosecutorial misconduct.
Yeah.
So that number's bad enough. That's a big number. But when you add to that the fact that what we call the Herculean burden to get an exoneration, when less than 1% of cases actually get exonerated, that number is shocking. It's scary to think about it. Like there's 4,000 that we know of only because they managed somehow to be one of the one in hundreds that actually it resulted in exoneration, and that's when we get to see it. There's so many other cases. There's many cases that I've worked on where prosecutorial misconduct was found, and it still didn't result in an exoneration. So we still don't see it in all the time. Like there's a Brady violation, and you know, or they didn't turn over something in discovery, and then the court will determine it's not material enough, or for whatever reason they give.
Harmless error,
right? And it's still prosecutorial misconduct. So the numbers are massive. But I want to shift into exactly what you're talking about, actually doing something about it. First of all, I really like, and I want to hear the thought behind it, what you named your organization, because what you're doing is fighting against prosecutorial misconduct. But you named the organization Protect Ethical Prosecutors, and I love that idea. I just had a little anecdotally from the police officer front, people tend to think because I work wrongful convictions and speak on it and work on it and advocate for it all the time that, you know, I hate police officers. Just last night, I got a flat tire on the side of a highway and I was out, you know, with semis whipping past me while I'm trying to there. And these two officers saw me, whipped around, pulled up, blocked traffic so that I wouldn't get run over by a semi, and then even helped change my tire. Like while I was jacking it up, they're loosening lug nuts for me. And I made a little post about it on social. And I had a couple people that were like, how can you even talk about, you know, this, you know, one good cop? I'm like, because I think that I want to hold up the guys that are doing it right, that are doing something good.
Exactly.
And so it's different, but it's the same to what you're doing here. So talk to me about when you founded the organization, how did you land on this name and what is your mission?
Well, okay. So the name, I get it. I mean, the name raises eyebrows, right? Mm-hmm. People, because of my background, it, really Irish, you want to protect ethical prosecutors. And I 100%, you know, we're not defending prosecutors as a group. That's not the point. Real accountability is what we're looking for. And mm-hmm. that protects the ethical majority and the public at the same time.
Yeah.
And so, look, I mean, when there are no consequences for intentional misconduct, which is what we're, which is really the landscape and where we're looking to eliminate immunity for, right? The worst actors repeat it and every prosecutor gets painted with the same brush, right?
Right.
So victims are the why, the name, but Protect Ethical Prosecutors is the how. And that's really that answers, I think, the name question. And, you know, accountability done right is intent-based, right? We're not getting at the good faith mistakes that prosecutors make, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's an enormous amount of ethical prosecutors who make good faith mistakes. There are.
Right.
But that's this, what we're targeting here is the knowing, intentional, and reckless and pattern misconduct, not the good faith judgment calls. And there's a way to do that. And listen, most ethical prosecutors already live by those standards. This is nothing new, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so something that I want to go back to that you said was, like, you were talking about the numbers and the scale, and what we actually know and what we don't know. There's nothing more hidden, by the way, and you know this, than the actual numbers of prosecutors who commit misconduct, right? We don't know because, you know, 98% of criminal cases result in a plea bargain.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And those cases, the public does not have any idea what happened in that case.
Oftentimes the defendant doesn't know. I just had someone on a couple weeks ago, Heather Lewis, who runs the Reuniting Bail Fund, where they're working on like participatory defense, and she was talking about how many times someone's accepting a plea bargain or a plea deal, and they have no idea that the evidence that the prosecutor is showing the defense attorney is easily refuted. You know, they don't know what's going on.
Exactly, and it's and usually I was talking to somebody the other day similarly. That he works a lot in the area of of the criminal legal system, and he was saying, like, how is it that, and he was looking at from the other side, which is good, and he said, you know, how is it that so and so got off with such a sweetheart plea deal, and I said, right, that upsets you, right, and you don't know, and I said, in my experience, when someone who appears to be a really bad actor, you know, has been all over the news as being a, you know, terrible criminal, as a villain, and we got to watch out for this person, we should be scared of this person, and they go balls to the walls against this person, right? And then they end up with this, like, probation deal. It usually is because the prosecutors probably did something unethical.
Mm-hmm.
And the defense found out about it, and the defense protects their clients by taking a deal, and the prosecutors give them a deal that's going to protect themselves, and no one ever knows about it.
So it doesn't get exposed.
Never gets exposed, and a lot of these cases that end up plea bargained are also in the world of cases get dismissed by prosecutors. At the height of where a judge has discovered they've committed misconduct, and then the prosecutors dismiss the case to evade punishment, and those cases in Colorado that get sealed, so you can't ever find out about anything that happened in the case. The case doesn't even look like it ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
You can't look it up. It's gone. It's disappeared. And so it is the most, you know, unbelievable hidden type of misconduct, more than even, you know, police officers are put on Brady lists across different cities and states in this country. And there's laws around it in Colorado and California, at least that I know of. But, you know, with prosecutors, there's no such thing. And so part of this protecting ethical prosecutors is making them accountable publicly, because, you know, if you can sue a prosecutor, their name ends up on a pleading, right?
Right.
Instead of being on the top of the caption of a lawsuit, they're under the V, you know, so it would be, you know, person wrongly accused versus the DA, right? And I'll tell you, most prosecutors want to avoid being there. Mm-hmm. And that's why they fight so hard at wanting to, lift the shield that they have so been granted by the United States Supreme Court 50 years ago. They don't want the people to know when they might have done something that's unethical. That's the last thing they want. They don't want to be ever looked at in a way where they did something wrong, right? Because they're the ones that are supposed to be doing the right things. So this is an incentive, you know, to be able to have somebody have the right to file a claim against a prosecutor is going to, I can't give a guarantee, but I strongly believe, based on the research, that prosecutors that are unethical will stop playing by the ends justify the means and stop cutting corners and stop doing unethical things and maybe stop charging people that shouldn't be charged and hand over all the evidence in cases because they don't want their names being on a caption where they're
so
being
sued. What is Protect Ethical Prosecutors doing to change that?
So Protect Ethical Prosecutors, first thing is what I'm doing here, which is hoping that we can educate as many people in the country as possible, because this is really such a silent, hidden issue, just like it was for me, for some, mm-hmm. even in criminal defense, you know, and a lot of public defenders don't even know you can't sue prosecutors. They don't see the scope of this policy and how it might affect them. So the first thing is, you know, I love for people to understand that prosecutors can't be sued. They're shocked, right? You could sue a doctor, you could sue lawyers, you could sue police officers, you could sue your nail tech, you could sue a podcast host, but you can't sue a prosecutor who commits case misconduct, who intentionally and knowingly hides evidence in your case and sends you to prison for decades. Cannot sue them. All right. So that's the first thing that PEP is doing, is that we're trying to educate people that don't know this, which is pretty much 99% of the public. The second thing that we're doing is we're raising money so that we can do two things. We can change the laws around the country, state by state, starting in Colorado, where we've already eliminated immunity for police officers. We think that there should be some parity with prosecutors,
mm-hmm.
And that prosecutors also should be open to lawsuit. Right now, police officers are taking the fall a lot of the time for mm-hmm. prosecutors. And so, you know, they wouldn't have to, you know, use all their insurance money, by the way, if prosecutors had to hold the bag for their own misconduct. And right now they're not, right? They're completely shielded. So we'd like to start either in the legislature, and I can talk to you about what that looked like this last year in Colorado. It was unbelievable. The boldness in which the prosecutors prevented us from being able to get a bill into our legislature. They bullied legislators. They bullied the political process and me and our organization in order to avoid getting this like in front of the legislator. And so the alternative way, obviously, is for the people to be able to decide themselves and take this out of the hands of prosecutors who are now policing themselves, right? And so that's through a ballot measure.
Okay.
And a ballot measure is the most sensible way, honestly, because we did a poll with a very reputable pollster in Colorado. And really no holds barred in terms of how we conducted the poll, really throwing, you know, what potential opposition would be, and also including a lot of the Colorado exonerations and cases that have occurred in Colorado that are just so egregious and alarming. And what came out in that poll was that 83% of Coloradans, regardless of their political party, their age, their gender, their race, didn't matter. 83% support eliminating immunity for prosecutors when they commit intentional and knowing misconduct. Okay. They think that people should have the right. They're shocked that they don't.
Yeah.
So a ballot measure is really the way to go, probably after what we experienced in the Colorado legislature was really, you know, just to think that. And it costs a lot of money, a ballot measure. It costs a lot of money
mm-hmm.
Because you got a campaign, you got to get the petition signed. But I believe in this. And I believe that The people are backing this. Our board, if you look at the strength of our board and where these people have been and what they've done in their careers and the fact that they back, this isn't like an Iris vengeance thing. This is a real policy issue that will forever, I think, change the way the criminal legal system conducts itself, because it is really prosecutors that are the most powerful in this country. That has been said over and over again by many prosecutors in the Supreme Court themselves, right? So I think that's the way to go. And it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of education of the public. And that's why we're here, to get that support and the backing and just have people to understand that's how we can do it. I don't think it's case by case is what we need to do right now in terms of, you know, our conviction integrity units and exonerations. HEP, we're creating our own database right now of misconduct, and it's not, I'll tell you right now, it's horrible. The cases that we're being able to sketch out in Colorado, it's not easy to do, but we have more than 250 cases of founded misconduct that would be hidden if we didn't have the information. These aren't like cases that have gone up to the appellate or Supreme Court. These are trial level cases where judges have dismissed felony and misdemeanor cases because of prosecutorial misconduct. Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you right now, we've only scratched the surface, because it's very hard to get the information. Most people that are wrongly accused don't want anyone to know, right? Because mm-hmm. No one believes you. If you say I was wrongly accused, they still think you're guilty. I mean, look at Amanda Knox, right? You know, you're like, oh, right. That was totally technicality. No one can actually believe it. And when you tell them stories, you know, I think the best case, the best human story to tell, I think currently, I mean, there's a lot, there's so many, but the one that is, I think, the most easy to explain to people who kind of are, you know, are the more prosecutorial oriented, is the Richard Glossop case. Because it's not Iris saying so, or one judge saying so, or one appellate court saying so. It's the United States Supreme Court that we currently have. Okay. This Supreme Court, I think everybody knows that the 9 justices that are serving us right now are very politically oriented towards the Republicans. Everybody mm-hmm. knows that. Okay. That's not I'm not making a partisan statement. And they're hardly protective over, I guess what you would say is a classic criminal, right? Mm-hmm. And so they reversed Richard Glossop's death penalty conviction after he was sent to be executed 5 times. I mean, he had 5 final meals.
Yeah.
And after 25 years of spending time in prison, most of it on death row from Oklahoma, this our United States Supreme Court reversed his conviction, not just stayed his execution. They reversed, but they did it because the prosecutor on the case 25 years ago, Connie Smotherman, who's now a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma, teaching law students how to mm-hmm. practice law, she withheld the fact that the only witness against Richard Glossop, who was a snitch witness, that she knew things about him and asked him questions that she knew weren't true. And so things that he said were false and that were completely biased and that could have been attacked by Richard Glossop's lawyers, and he probably would not have been convicted. And the Supreme Court agreed with that. It wasn't just Richard Glossop's lawyers saying so.
Right.
The Supreme Court said, had she not lied and put on this witness that she knew was lying, he probably would not have been convicted and spent 25 years in prison. And so his conviction was reversed. Nothing has happened to Connie Smotherman. In fact, somebody asked, a member of the press asked the Attorney General of Oklahoma last year, what are you going to do to Connie Smotherman? Are you going to prosecute her? Are you going to, you know, turn her into the bar? so she could lose her law license? Are you going to write a letter to the bar, to like her law school? No, it's been too many. He said, nearly in quotes, he said, it's been too long for me to do anything. Been too long. In Richard Glossop, it's insane. And so this is, so if I was a prosecutor, an unethical prosecutor, and I was like, I had CNN and I had 48 hours and they were following me doing my court case and I was going to get this conviction and probably going to run for election next year as an elected DA. And I had maybe something that I didn't think anyone was going to find out about. And I see the Supreme Court decision and nothing happened to this prosecutor and big deal, this person gets their conviction reversed 25 years later. You think I'm going to do? Okay, so they're not incentivized to play by the rules. They're incentivized to win.
Right.
And until people like Connie Smotherman and all the prosecutors that have committed, I worked hard on a case in Colorado. It was the last case I handled before I started PEP. And I quit practicing law because I was so disgusted with the pattern of misconduct that I'd witnessed. And I worked hard to file a complaint against the 7 prosecutors in that case. And for the first time in Colorado history, the elected DA who I filed a complaint against, she was disbarred. But it took me a year and a half to write that complaint, Bob.
Yeah.
And it took the Attorney Regulation Council another year to, fight that case and get her disbarred. And most of the prosecutors around are like, of course she should have been disbarred. Of course she should have been disbarred. She's a pariah, but when other prosecutors do similar misconduct, that wasn't as bad as you think, or that was a mistake, or that was a good faith error. And it just, when it became so publicized what she did, they hold her out as a unicorn, but she's not a unicorn.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times prosecutors will say, Iris, you see, the system works. You got somebody disbarred. It works. What do you mean? She's no longer the elected DA. And you know what I say to that? 2 things. One, she is the only DA in Colorado history that's been disbarred for egregious case misconduct. And 2, her predecessor, no, her successor is the right way to say it. So the person now that took over the job for her and is now the elected DA, he was in court in December 2025, so 5 months ago, on a triple homicide. And the judge presiding over that case told him that she was going to grant the defense request for sanctions for his misconduct in the case because he was hiding evidence in the case and made misstatements about witnesses in the case, and that she was doing that because he had a pattern of committing misconduct ever since he took over the job from the disbarred prosecutor and listed out 5 other cases where he had done that in the last year. Okay, that DA was one of the DAs that I filed a complaint against in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And what did the bar do to him?
Sounds like nothing.
Nothing. They gave him a warning. They said, you're telling us you know the rules of discovery, like what you have to hand over, and we're going to take you at your word. And that's what they did. And look what now he's doing. So that is what we can say about how great that system of attorney regulation works. And I'm not blaming them. I'm not throwing them under the bus. I'm not saying they don't do their job well enough. But look, they don't work in the work that Bob, you look at every day and that I worked in for 30 years. They don't understand it and they can't take all of this on. And also, it's hard to go after prosecutors. They don't want to go after their own. Judges don't want to go after them. Prosecutors don't turn in their own colleagues, right? No one's filing complaints. Even defense lawyers don't file complaints against prosecutors because guess what? They have a case against them with another client they believe is innocent. And so right. What are they going to do? They're going to file a complaint against this prosecutor, and then they're going to have their other clients suffer. And a lot of clients don't want to have their cases going in front of the Attorney Regulation Council because they've gotten their case dismissed. They're done. They want right. to move on with their life. So you know, the prosecutors thrive in the secrecy and the fact that they can hide. And so, you know, I think bringing this out and what we want to do is make them publicly accountable. So being able to talk about this publicly so that people understand the scope of this problem, can get educated about why it's happening, and then what we intend to do about it. And I'm not going away. And PEP's not going away. We're not. We're not going away. We're not going anywhere. We're just getting bigger and stronger. And I think we have all the credibility that we need. You know, it's just we need more people to know about it. That's what we need.
Well, and I think you've reached the right audience here. You know, my audience is very much a take action type of crowd, and they want to get involved. I'm just looking at your website right now. For those of you guys listening as we're wrapping this up, that if you go to protectethicalprosecutors.org, right at the top on the right hand side, there is a take action button, and there is a donate button where you can donate to help out, join the movement, a place to report prosecutorial misconduct, and recognizing a section to recognize ethical prosecutors. So I'd encourage you all to go to the website, check it out, donate if you can, get involved. I think this movement is fantastic. I'm glad I could go on for hours about how all these different problems all layer on top of each other. You know, when you were just talking about, and yeah, I'll need to shut up because I'm going too long, but it's like, well, the defense attorney doesn't want to file the complaint against the DA because they got another case. Well, that's also part of the problem with 98% of the cases being pled out, because they're, you know, they have to exactly. be able to have a relationship to make deals and keep it. There's so many problems. I love what you guys are doing. I love the organization and the work you've done so far. Hopefully lots of our listeners get involved and help out. And with that, Iris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and educating us about this. And myself, and I'm sure most of my audience is super excited to help.
Thank you. Follow us too on Instagram, End Prosecutor Misconduct. Thank you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale, from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's. Online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.